Case number
11-15-05. May it please the court, Theodore Frank for appellant Kimberly Craven pro bono. Walmart versus Dukes had two primary holdings, and unfortunately the district court failed to apply each of them correctly. And these independent errors of law, in addition to the other errors we identified in our briefs, provide grounds for reversing the court's settlement approval. First of all, the district court found that the 23B2 settlement was appropriate because the relief was restitution-type payment or an equitable restitution in lieu of the injunctive relief sought by the parties in their initial complaint. But as Walmart versus Dukes confirmed, Rule 23B2 does not speak of equitable remedies generally, but of injunctions and declaratory judgments.
But in Walmart, the plaintiffs sought injunctive relief and back pay right from the beginning, correct?
Correct.
And here, the plaintiffs sought just injunctive relief, and in fact, the amended complaint that the district court eventually certified only sought injunctive relief. So isn't the question in this case whether or not plaintiffs who bring an injunctive action can settle for monetary relief? And that's a different question than Walmart raised, isn't it?
It's a slightly different question, but once they converted their injunctive complaint to a monetary complaint.
Well, but they didn't. The amended complaint that Judge Hogan certified only seeks injunctive relief.
That's correct.
Yeah. So the question really is whether an injunctive action can be settled for monetary relief. At least that's what the case looks like to me. But this doesn't mean you still mean you have a good case. I'm just trying to ask you what lens we look at this through.
And certainly that is an issue, but the critical issue is whether they can settle it for monetary relief and continue the B2 certification that's mandatory forbidding an opt-out.
Well, but suppose the court had concluded that you can settle a... Or suppose the rule is that you can settle an injunctive relief, a properly certified injunctive action for damages if it's fair, reasonable, and adequate. And it wouldn't be fair if the settlement wouldn't be fair if, you know, there are the kinds of interclass conflicts that you have alleged. I mean, in other words, do you see my point? It wouldn't, just because you look at the issue the way I just asked you about, that is whether you can settle an injunctive action for money, doesn't mean that the approval here is appropriate. You still have the fair, reasonable, and adequate question.
I think that's correct. I think you can hypothesize a settlement where the value of the injunctive relief is so small and the monetary relief given to every class member is so large that no class member is left lacking.
Right.
And in that very rare instance, I can't even...
So if you look at it the way we were just talking about, what's the fatal flaw here then?
The fatal flaw here is, as this court identified in Cobell 22, not every class member is identically situated, and not every class member is fairly treated by $1,000 compensation for the...
But how do we know that at this point of the litigation?
Well, for one thing, it's their burden to demonstrate.
It's whose burden?
It's the settling party's burden to demonstrate.
I thought the burden was on you here to show that the district court abused discretion in approving the settlement.
Well, the district court never made a finding that $1,000 would adequately compensate every single class member.
Well, is there any evidence, what evidence would you point to in the record or that would suggest, your point, as I understand it, is that the risk here is that some class members will be overcompensated and others undercompensated, right?
That's one of our complaints, yes.
Yeah. So what evidence is there that that is likely to happen or might happen? Is there any? You haven't pointed to anything that
I disagree. We have the lead plaintiff's own testimony before Congress about individual class members who, because of improper accounting, lost millions of dollars. We have the Two Shields class action that's currently pending in the Court of Claims, which alleges hundreds of millions of dollars that have been lost pursuant to trust misadministration. And my own client has a variety of trust interests, and she has no idea whether that's worth $1,000 or not, because as this court identified in Cobell 22, can't know whether it's worth $1,000 until you have the actual accounting.
But is there any, given the circumstances of this case, I understand that point, but given the circumstances of this case, given Cobell 22 and given the fact that Congress isn't going to appropriate the money, what kind of accounting could be done that would possibly answer that question?
Well, Cobell 22 authorized the district court to identify the low-hanging fruit and create subgroups within the B2 class that would be entitled to an accounting, and other class members, the class members with 15 cents in their accounts and no conceivable claim to a larger account, would not get an accounting. And, you know, again, this is something that this court directly addressed in Cobell 22, that just giving everybody a per capita payment, and that's something the government said in its briefing in Cobell 22, that just simply giving everybody in the class a per capita payment is, one, not permissible under B2, and two, would be arbitrary and unfair. The Cobell 22 didn't reach the B2 issue, but the government did say that in their briefing in that case. And I think Walmart and T-Corp Title Trust, these cases identify the potential problem if you take an injunctive case under B2 and turn it into a monetary case.
Of course, the whole theory here was the plaintiff's case seeking a historical accounting was so they would be able to identify any amounts they were due by the government. And the district court here looked at the case somewhat differently than we've been discussing so far, didn't it? And I need to know what's wrong with that. In other words, the $1,000 was not a per capita damages award,
but
was consideration for giving up the right to an historical accounting.
In my mind, that's a distinction without a legal material difference.
Well, we all know from studying property law that, you know, consideration can be very different than the actual value. And I thought that was the concept that the district court was applying here.
Well, certainly.
And why, if he was, why was that impermissible as a matter of settlement here?
Because it's a B2 class and the class members aren't getting to choose whether they want that consideration. No class members are not given the opportunity to opt out that Walmart versus Dukes considered to be of constitutional importance. I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time very quickly on the standing question.
Before you get to that, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm still not sure I understand. Well, let me ask you this. Do you agree with me that that whether or not this is your client has a right to an accounting, and whether this settlement is unfair, whether you look at it as a certification issue or a 23E issue, turns on whether there's any way to, through an accounting, to determine that some members of the class are being overcompensated and others undercompensated, right? Would you agree let me put it this way. Suppose there was virtually no way to show that. Would you agree then that this is fair?
that there's no way to show it, then what happens then? I apologize that I don't understand.
That, in other words, if it was pretty clear from the record that no accounting that Congress would fund would reveal the kinds of discrepancies that would make between beneficiaries that would make this unfair, would you agree then that the district court didn't abuse its discretion?
I would agree that if Congress announced that nobody ever gets an accounting and therefore no class member could possibly win $1,000 from the accounting, then the $1,000 would be fair in that
situation. Well, so the reason I ask is that in Cobell, I think it was 20, the district court had the 07 plan before it, and that plan, which would have cost another $100 or so million, which nobody had, that plan would have only sampled about 6,000 transactions would have been reconciled, which is infinitesimal given the size of the class and the number of transactions. I mean, that's the best I've seen so far that is possible, and even that isn't affordable. So given that, if the court ordered that accounting, it wouldn't produce the evidence about the possible discrepancies you fear exist here, correct?
No, well, we don't know.
But it wouldn't. There's no way it could. I mean, virtually all of the beneficiaries, with looking at that few number of accounts and transactions, you know, 99% of the beneficiaries' accounts wouldn't even be looked at. You wouldn't know.
But there's still the other 1%, and all it would take is one account and one mistransaction
to
of over $1,000.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the Supreme Court has addressed this a couple of times now in Hodel versus Irving and Babbitt versus UP. And they say, we recognize this is a big problem, but you don't get to scythe. You don't get to knock everybody out in the interests of – you don't get to take the procedural shortcut to resolve the problem. And that's what happened here.
So just so I'm clear, going back in this case some way, there was consideration of using statistical modeling to – develop a historical accounting, and the plaintiffs rejected that. What does that do to your argument?
I don't think that affects my argument one way or the other.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is Judge Tatel has been discussing with you the impossibility of getting the type of accounting that you're seeking because of the cost involved, and Congress made it clear it was not going to appropriate that amount of money. An earlier alternative had been the notion of using statistical modeling because the department had indicated it didn't have certain records or couldn't find them. So when this court later identified the low-hanging fruit, you seem to be clear what that meant. I'm not clear what that meant.
No, well, I don't think anybody is, but... I think statistical evidence could show that there would be some class members that would be undercompensated by the flat $1,000 Procrustean relief here. But that still leaves the trust administration class, which is the other Walmart problem, and the other issues we raised, even if we somehow decide that a B2 class can be certified for monetary relief.
What do you think of this? One of the red briefs points out that there was this study that that examined 99% of the IAM account transfers over a 20-year period and found no non-minor errors at all. Much less, they didn't find any major errors at all. What do we think about that?
That was just, I think, for the named plaintiffs. They didn't find any major errors with the named plaintiffs. But maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. My recollection.
Well, I ask because I didn't see a response to this point in your reply brief.
The study.
it tracked 48 million. 48 million of the 49 million IM transactions during a 20-year period, and found no evidence of any major problems.
And that goes to the strength of the plaintiff's claims.
No, I'm just asking, since the question here is whether or not an accounting is likely to produce the inter-class discrepancies that you're worried about, this suggests that it wouldn't.
For any given class member, if you pick a class member, are they likely to have a discrepancy? The answer is no. Across the entire class that is affected and do not have the choice whether or not to opt out, I think it is likely that someone will have that discrepancy. But it's impossible to say, because we have this arbitrary distribution that Cobell 22 criticized. Very quickly on the standing, 28 U.S.C. 1653 permits reconciliation of any problems at the appellate level. Should you disagree with my argument that Devlin in Rule 23E5 provides standing? I'm over my time. I hope I'll get some rebuttal time, but if not, thank you.
Yeah, we'll get a couple. Thank you. Yeah.
May it please the Court, my name is Thomas Bondi. I represent the defendants' appellees, the Secretary of the Interior et al. Your Honors, at issue here is whether the District Court abused its discretion in approving the congressionally authorized settlement of the Cobell Indian Trust case. The answer to that question is no. This settlement is in all respects rational and sensible. Its terms are fair to the members of the plaintiff class, and in the government's view, the settlement represents a significant and welcome step forward in terms of Indian trust reform. Respectfully, Your Honors, the judgment below should be affirmed. Before turning to any of the specific issues, it's also important to bear in mind, Your Honors, this was an extraordinary settlement, even by the standards of large class action settlements. This settlement, by its terms, in order to become effective, required congressional legislation. Congress had to pass a statute in order to make this.
No, that's almost true with any government settlement, so I don't think that gets you too far.
Well,
I mean, you know, sometimes it can be paid out of, you know, a settlement fund that the agency may have, but anything significant, you're going to have to get an appropriation.
Maybe, Your Honor, but the statute here doesn't just provide a large appropriation. It does other significant things, too.
Yeah, but look, let me just continue with Judge Rogers. Just said. Well, if there were evidence that some members of the class were being overcompensated and others undercompensated, it wouldn't make any difference how big and important this settlement is.
That's true.
Wouldn't it be unfair?
Your Honor, ultimately.
So why don't we focus on that question?
That's fine, Your Honor.
This court, more than anyone else, knows how long it's taken to get here. We got that point. Cobell 22 tells us that. It's not Cobell 1. It's not Cobell 2. It's 22. We got the point.
Okay.
Why don't you focus on the issue? Their primary argument is this thing's unfair because you know there's no evidence that the harm done by the agency over these years is equally spread among all the beneficiaries.
Well, as some of the questioning before indicated, Your Honor, it is hard to answer that kind of question in a context like this with absolute precision, and that kind of precision is not required. There is an element of rough justice here, but this isn't random and arbitrary. The different pieces of the compensation here make sense and are fair, and from our point of view, if I can explain, are actually generous. This is more than a fair settlement. It's a generous settlement. And if I can go through, Your Honor,
That's again, not the question they're raising. They're not challenging the size of the settlement. That's not their concern.
If we can go through the three different pieces of the compensation, Your Honor, because there really are three. The way the settlement works.
It would help me if you would just focus on this primary argument they make about the unfairness of it that stems from their allegation that some people will be over and others undercompensated.
Well,
and we don't know the answer to that. But let me ask you the question this way. Suppose there was one member of the class who had accept your argument about how difficult the accounting is going to be and how expensive they are and how it's unlikely. Suppose one member of the class had clear evidence that her account was, that the $2,000 was grossly inadequate compared to the errors in her account?
I guess I have two reactions to that, Your Honor. I understand the question, and I'm not trying to dodge it, but it's hard to see how that scenario could present itself. But in any event, I don't think that makes the
settlement. She's kept really good records, and she has proof that substantial amounts of money have disappeared from her IAM account.
Comes from a long line of accountants.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
and she's got clear evidence. That's my hypothetical.
I guess
she's got evidence that $100,000 was missing from this account.
Okay,
and a CPA has certified that.
Okay, fair enough.
That person's going to get $2,000. Can't opt that.
Just to be clear, Your Honor, there is a record here. We are not aware of the existence.
This was a hypothetical.
I don't think that makes the settlement fair as to the class, and any person who is dissatisfied, and this is crucial for due process and other reasons, any person ultimately who is dissatisfied, this does retain the option of opting out.
As to the
trust administration class, that is the class that deals with monetary claims.
The part is that if I don't have the evidence, namely an historical accounting, it's going to be very difficult for me to prove my case as a member of the second class. So that's why the lawsuit was brought in the beginning.
It is why the lawsuit was brought in the beginning, but also, as Your Honors know, this has been discussed, the reason why we are here now is it turns out that the accounting project, as Your Honors know, became mired in protracted litigation, and it turns out that search, that quest for a full and robust accounting was much, much more complicated and much, much more costly than anyone anticipated at the outset.
So our analysis ought to be in the realm of impossibility in that sense? I mean, given that Congress had clearly stated it was not going to fund an historical accounting, at least as it understood would be required to grant the relief sought by the complaint?
Yeah, I'm not sure the word impossibility is the right word.
I'm trying to think of a framework for where we're in this, as it were, black box, and you could have this hypothetical, but we don't know. That's what I'm getting at.
But also, remember, Your Honor, there is a compensation formula here that is keyed in significant part to the revenues, the flow through, if you will, of each individual's IIM account. So there's a compensation formula that, in a rational, admittedly rough justice kind of way, keys the individual's compensation in significant part to the individual's circumstances, the circumstances of the IIM account.
So you're telling me then, I guess I hadn't understood this completely, that take Mrs. Craven here. She can protect all of her interests by opting out of the trust administration class and get an accounting?
I wouldn't put it quite that way when you say protect all of her interests, because there are two classes here. One of them is not an opt-out class. Ms. Craven is a member of both. She cannot opt out of the accounting class. She can opt out of the trust administration class.
So if she opts out, what can she do?
She retains whatever rights she always had to file a claim against the United States for money damages in the Court of Federal Claims, and has available to her whatever evidentiary tools and discovery tools are available in such a proceeding. And, of course, the government has available to it whatever defenses might be available, including, for example, statute of limitations. And in that context, the Court of Federal Claims does have a concept of what it calls an accounting in aid of jurisdiction, which is not the same thing as a full backward-looking historical accounting, but it is an accounting concept. But, Judge Tatel, I just want to be clear that members of this class do give something up. They give up their historical accounting claims. I don't want to leave any doubt about that. But they can opt out of the second class, which is the class for money damages, and proceed with whatever money claims they think they have as they see fit in the Court of Federal Claims. And I think that opt-out right does answer a lot of the questions in this case. But, again, going back to the formula in the trust administration class, that is a formula that tries to key compensation in a significant way to the individual circumstances of the particular class member based roughly on the size and the duration of that person's IIM account activity.
Does the government still believe that Mrs. Craven lacks standing?
Well, I'm not sure we ever believed it to the extent you put it that way. And let me explain, Your Honor. and this was really limited to a footnote in our brief, as we read the blue brief, the Craven appellant's brief, we thought that what she was saying in part, not in whole, in part, is that the settlement is unfair because it is unfair to other people, not to her. We understood her to be saying that, and our very limited, modest point on standing is we don't think she has standing to make that claim. That's all we're saying. Of course she has standing to assert her own rights and perceived injuries to herself. Of course she does.
Of course, one of her arguments, not arguments, but is that she didn't opt out, so she'd be in a position to make the arguments she's making today.
Well, and that's fine, but she can make the arguments on behalf of herself. She can't point to other people who are not in her circumstances, who could have objected but did not, who could have opted out but did not, and who could have appealed and did not, and argue here that the settlement is unfair because it's unfair to those people. She doesn't represent those people. She represents herself. And I think that's a very limited, modest point. That's our only point on standing. And we're not trying to foreclose this court's inquiry into the overall fairness of the settlement.
Let me just, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Mr. Frank. Are we dealing with a certification issue or a fairness question?
Both, Your Honor. I think both are presented. The certification of the trust administration class.
No, the historical class. I'm only talking about the historical class.
Okay, Your Honor. I'm not sure the certification of that class is directly presented. It's a bit hard to tell. In some respect, maybe that question and the fairness question are wrapped up together. But, I mean, the Craven brief directly attacks the certification of the second class, the TAC. But we don't, to go back to the beginning of the oral argument, Your Honor, we certainly think that a B2 class for injunctive relief can be settled for a flat money payment. And if that were not true, you'd have a lot of cases like this one, cases for injunctive relief that become mired in litigation that people reasonably want to settle and can't settle. Because really, in many cases, the practical way to settle it will be just for a flat money payment to release the injunctive claims. And it can't be that in a reasonable sense, the parties can't get together and do that. Your Honors, I know that my red light is on. Unless the court has any further questions, I have nothing more.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Adam Charnas, and I represent the plaintiff class. Maybe to start, Judge Tatel, with one of the questions you asked again at the end, I believe that there are two separate questions that Mrs. Craven muddles together with respect to the historical accounting class. And the first question is whether the historical accounting class was properly certified, and then if it was, the second question is whether it's fair under Rule 23E. And in that regard, in the first question, it's important to note that this class essentially was certified 15 years ago in 1997. The amended complaint that was filed made minor modifications to the scope of the class in order to conform with decisions of this court and the district court. For example, direct pay beneficiaries were removed from the class in accord with prior decisions. But otherwise, the class was certified 15 years ago. So we don't believe that Walmart's holding has anything to say about that. As you noted at the beginning, the historical accounting class seeks solely injunctive relief. It fits comfortably under B2. It also fits, and this wasn't addressed earlier this morning, under B1A. The fact of the matter is that...
So you see this question then as whether or not the district court finding of fairness, that's the key question then, right? Plaintiffs can settle injunctive actions for money, which is what happened here. But so that shifts the question to 23E, right? Is it fair?
I think that's right.
So what's your answer to the argument that without an accounting, there's no way of knowing whether this is equally fair to all members of the class?
Well, I think there are several responses. First of all, there has been done a great deal of work with the existing data, analyzing that data to determine whether there are significant accounting errors. And the class has diligently attempted to show over the course of 15 years that there were significant accounting errors. But the fact of the matter is that heretofore we've been largely unable to convince the district court that that is the case. Your Honor referred to the study We discussed it at page 29 of our brief, where the government studied almost 50 million transactions, and the government expert found only incredibly minor errors. In fact, Judge Robertson in Cobell 21 said that there was, despite the plethora of evidence that this trust has been mismanaged for a century or more than a century, that there, as he put it, there has been essentially no direct evidence of funds missing from the trust. So the evidence that exists now contradicts Craven's argument. And it's, I think it's important to note a point that I think both you and Judge Rogers made at the beginning, which is that this is an appeal. And Mrs. Craven is an appellant, and she needs to prove an abuse of discretion by the district court in finding the settlement to be fair. And it's her obligation, if she's making an assertion of an intra-class conflict, to come forward with evidence of that. And she, and numerous, we cite them in our briefs, several circuits have made that point. You can't come in and hypothesize that there may be an intra-class conflict, that there may be class members out there who are benefited and maybe some that are disadvantaged. And in fact, her argument is, I think if I read her blue brief correctly, she concedes that, of course, there's going to be some variation in class members, but her argument is premised on dramatic differences, some class members wildly overcompensated and some wildly undercompensated, and that somehow creates a conflict. Well, we don't know that that exists. In fact, all the evidence that has been tendered so far has been that that doesn't exist, and Judge Robertson certainly didn't think that existed. Moreover, as we argue in our brief, we don't think that creates an intra-class conflict anyway, because we don't know, any particular class member doesn't know which category he or she is in. And in the, we discussed the Yule case from the Seventh Circuit, which makes the point that if you don't know which category you're in, the advantage or the disadvantage, there can't be an intra-class
conflict. Well, but that, I don't think that really helps you because, you know, if an accounting could, in fact, identify different classes of a class, the fact that you don't know which one you're in before the accounting has been done doesn't really get you very far.
Well, but here,
Your argument, as I understood it, is that there's no accounting possible that could even determine it.
Well, in Yule, the Seventh Circuit case, eventually everybody knew which category they were in. That was the case where the railroad put laid fiber on one side of the railroad tracks or another. But when the case was settled, landowners didn't know which side the fiber would be on, and therefore the court held that there was no conflict. But you're absolutely right. It's crystal clear under Cobell 22, there is never going to be a meaningful accounting for this class,
right.
Both as a result of Cobell 22.
What did the court mean by low-hanging fruit?
Your Honor, I don't know. I think that's a question for you.
I wasn't. Never mind.
But even more important.
What do you think it meant?
Well,
it might have meant. Counsel suggested maybe the court had in mind subclasses.
Right. I know Mr. Frank wrote that in his reply brief, I think. I don't read Cobell 22 as at all suggesting there are separate classes or subclasses that should be created. I think what this court probably meant was that the easy data to analyze should be analyzed to see whether there are any mistakes in there. Part of the problem with that is, number one, the easy data have already been analyzed, and which Judge Robertson found.
Is that the study you were just talking about, the 20
among other
study?
Things, that's correct.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And moreover, even that, even the analysis of the low-hanging fruit is critically dependent on congressional appropriation. So if Congress appropriates $100 for the accounting under Cobell 22, that's sufficient. Moreover, we can't forget that the vast majority of records for this trust have been destroyed.
That's why I frame this in terms of, I'm trying to think about it in terms of impossibility. Not only are records lost, the department changed its method of accounting on two different occasions. Even if Congress said, you know, here's an open bank account, do the accounting. At some point, you're going to be into statistical modeling, and the plaintiffs rejected that approach early on.
That's right.
So where are we, in a sense?
So that's precisely why the settlement for the historical accounting class was established the way it was. It's a $1,000 payment that is not restitution to compensate class members for errors in their accounts, but is instead a payment to buy from them, essentially, to purchase from class members the right to an accounting. It's true the district court, Judge Hogan, did at one point from the bench refer to this as a restitutionary type of relief. It's clear that that from the context of his analysis, that's not a precise description. I don't think that's what he meant, that it was restitution, and that's not how the settlement is structured. It's not meant to say that on average class members are disadvantaged by $1,000 or most or some. It's simply purchasing from them the right, the government's obligation to do an accounting for everybody. And it's not possible, as Mr. Frank suggested, for a particular class member to stand up and say, I'd like an accounting. That's why there's no opt-out. This is a commingled unitary trust. It's not possible for one class member or 10 class members to say, well, just do an accounting for my funds, because the money for all class members was held in common, was commingled, and was, we alleged in the amended complaint, and the initial complaint was mismanaged in common.
Well, explain to me just a little, very briefly, what did the named plaintiffs receive?
Thank you for raising that, Your Honor. That's an important point. In, I believe for the first time in the reply brief, Mrs. Craven says, well, the named plaintiffs suffered no losses, and they received an accounting, and the accounting that they received showed that they were minimal losses, and that's not accurate. And if I could have a minute just to describe the background, because I think it will take a few seconds to describe this. In the district court's initial discovery order, it ordered the government to produce all trust records related to the named plaintiffs and their predecessors in interest, and the government had a difficult time doing that. Ultimately, in satisfaction of that obligation, they produced a report, which was referred to as the Rosenbaum Report, which attempted to analyze the named plaintiffs' IAM account records to the extent that they existed. When that expert report was produced to the plaintiffs, plaintiffs' counsel was concerned that the government was going to take the position that Mr. Frank now takes, which is that was a full accounting under the 94 Act, and the plaintiffs filed a motion with the district court asking for a trial to be held on the adequacy of that accounting. And the government then took the position that, no, that was not an accounting satisfying the government's obligation to account, but it was just an expert report. And the reason, I suppose, the government did that is that there were severe problems with the analysis of the named plaintiffs. For one of the named plaintiffs, the government could not find any IAM trust records at all. For the other named plaintiffs, they conceded that about 1/7 of all of the accounting, all of the transactions were not backed up by documents. And what Mr. Rosenbaum did was, he basically did a bookkeeping exercise. He found a piece of paper that said $30 should have been credited to the trust account, and he went to the trust account and said, look, there's $30 there. But he never verified that $30 was the right amount. He never verified that $30 was supposed to go to, say, Mrs. Cobell's account as opposed to somebody else's account.
So your position is even, and I gather the government's position, even for that period of time as to those limited number of members of the class, it has been impossible to prepare an historical accounting.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I see that my time has expired. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Very quickly, they say that it's impossible to provide non-unitary relief for the accounting, but then they acknowledge that the named plaintiffs got their own accounting and may not have been a complete historical accounting, but they got a much better accounting than any other class member got. And that's why this case is not like Yule. In Yule, the named plaintiffs were in the same veil of ignorance as the rest of the class. Here, the named plaintiffs knew where they stood and knew what they could prove and what they could not prove within themselves. Mr. Charnas says that this is not restitution, but that is not what the plaintiff said below, and that's why the district court found it to be restitution. He was asked to find it to be restitution by the plaintiffs. Yes, this is reviewed on abuse of discretion, but if the district court applies the wrong standard of law, that is an abuse of discretion, and we've identified several different areas where we think the district court committed an error of law. With respect to the formula, I think that is
so
important.
So could I just be clear, and maybe everybody else understands this, if in this situation where it is impossible for the government to prepare an historical accounting for each member of the class, any settlement that gives up that right is necessarily unfair?
No. Any B2 settlement that
any B2 settlement is necessarily unfair.
That's correct. We take the position that there needs to be recertification under B3.
I see. All right.
And that's why you can't...
By the way, why would that... I mean, that wouldn't solve anything. Why would... The government wouldn't agree to that, right? Why would the government agree to a deal whereby individual plaintiffs can opt out and still seek a historic accounting? I mean, I think the more candid answer to Judge Rogers' question you might have given is that it can't be settled for giving up the historic accounting, right?
Well,
if you were advising the Interior Department, you wouldn't advise them to. They don't even need a lawyer to know not to sign that deal, right?
Well, if the Interior Department thinks that they can't offer enough to the class, that nobody would opt out from the historical accounting, right?
Well, see, your point then, your real point is that this case can't be settled.
No, the case can be settled. It has to be a settlement.
Without an accounting. That's your point. Because either, I think that's what you're saying.
Well, the case
it can't be settled without a historic accounting.
The case can be settled. For example, the parties could agree to the scope of the injunctive relief.
Wait, what does that mean? You mean for less of a historic accounting?
They could agree what the low-hanging fruit is.
But they could agree to a low-hanging fruit. But
is that the same as what Judge Cato's question?
Yeah. None of us know what that means.
Well,
I don't know what it means. I mean, we've got the best deal I've seen is the 07 historic accounting. I haven't seen anything in there that looks any more practical. Even that isn't affordable. But that, as I said to you when we were first talking, wouldn't reveal anything about interclass discrepancies.
Well, there was a settlement before Congress in 2006-2007 to provide $7 billion to perform substantial historical accounting.
Congress won't pay for it.
What?
Congress won't pay for it.
Well, the earlier settlement is one that the plaintiffs rejected rather than Congress rejected. But, and you know, maybe at this point, I mean, we can't judge this based on what a future Congress may
do. No, but I think, okay, now you're getting more candid, right? I mean, you really are saying that this case can't be settled without an adequate historic accounting, and Interior's obligation here, or at least the plaintiffs have the right to tell Interior to go back to Congress, right?
I mean, I think Interior can say, we are going to offer enough money and talk to the people who want to opt out and convince them that they shouldn't opt out, that it's in their best interest to agree to the settlement. And offer the historical accounting class a B3 settlement.
You mean just the people who object would get the historic accounting?
I don't understand. Well, I mean, the people who object are going to have to go and bring their own Section 4011 claim. They'll have to find a lawyer to do that, and they'll have to go against the Department of Interior's defenses.
But all the recent decisions in this case say, under the circumstances, an historic accounting is not possible. An historic accounting that would provide the information you, seems to me, quite properly want. But the record of this case suggests that's not going to happen.
Well,
and you're telling me that still means that this case can't be settled without the impossible historic accounting. So it can't be settled.
If this court overrules Cobell 22 and says that an historical accounting is impossible, which they rejected the district court's finding of that and said, no, some historical accounting is
possible. Yeah, the question, though, is there's no question. You're absolutely right about that. Some historic accounting is possible. The question is whether an historic accounting is possible, whether the historic accounting that is possible is one that would yield the information you are looking for. And I don't see that in this record. That's
again, we're relying on what this court has already found in Cobell 22. Okay. If the court wants to make a different finding, different results certainly accrue. Mm-hmm. Okay. With respect to the formula that the parties are relying on I think that that's very important to the idea of overcompensation and undercompensation. My client, who gets $1,000 a year from her trust account, is entitled to $1,400 or so from this formula. A class member with 10 cents a year from their trust account is entitled to $800 under this formula. And as we documented, my client believes that she has valid trust administration claims that are being wiped out by this settlement. I'm happy to take any other questions you have. I think there are other errors of law, such as the 23A4 issue. And I'm happy to answer your questions. If not, thank you.
No, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.